The really successful business person, the people who stick with the truth, do you have the guts and the discipline to face the truth?
What part of company building do you find entrepreneurs deceiving themselves with the most?
It's going to take 100 pitches before it's making sense. We're at about 83 now, so we've got 17 left to get it right.
But how will you know when it's right?
Oh, God, that's a hell of a good question. You know when it's right when you can... I have unbelievable faith in humanity, that people crave beauty and newness. They just need the handcuffs taken off them and they need to be set free to think and to dream.
What are the handcuffs?
Commerce is riddled with handcuffs. Let's deal with most people.
I'd rather deal with you.
You'd rather, okay.
One thing I heard you say is that you wanted to make a difference, to be admired. I wanted people to look at me and say, wow, this guy is so serious and onto something. He matters.
Okay, so that's deeply personal. Perhaps I felt ignored as a child. I don't know.
Thank you so much for coming. Welcome to the show. So you spoke before about what most entrepreneurs potentially struggle with in terms of this search for truth. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, you asked me. I think you asked me what, if I was to give advice, what is it? What advice would I most often give? And I referred you to the most important thing of all. Two things. Number one, I said, it's not a phrase I use very much, entrepreneur. I don't know what an entrepreneur is. I'm not an entrepreneur. I'm a person who started a business. I sell a product or a range of products. So I'm not big on, I think most people should drop that expression, entrepreneur, for lots of reasons. We can't go into now, it'll take too long. But the truth is what I talked to you about. Generally speaking, the people who are worthy of your admiration are people who stick with the truth. And in business, it's particularly important. If you make a product and you expect people to buy that product, you've got to be brutally honest about that product and about your service and about your marketing and about your effectiveness. You can't kid yourself. You do have to believe in your product, obviously. But it's equally helpful to be unbelievably honest about how effective it is, how good it is, how good you are at doing what it is you're trying to do. All my life, I've had people come to me saying, here, I would like you to buy this extraordinary product. And that you say, why is it extraordinary and why might I buy it? And then when you compare it to other products, it's very often far worse. And not even not less expensive or anything. So you have to ask them, why would I buy this product? And the simple answer is that it's because they've put a lot of work into it. But how does that affect our customers? Or do you see what I mean? You've got to stick with the truth.
That sounds like truth that's customer-facing in terms of your marketing. What about truth when it comes to
They're related.
Internal?
They're related, aren't they? Do you have the guts and the discipline to face the truth and accept the truth? About your own self-discipline, about your own commitment to your product, or are you kidding yourself? You know? And then, of course, there's the subject of the truth with how you work with people. Building trust with the people you work with is incredibly important. I think you'll find most really good, great leaders, they know how to build trust. Trust is high. Very difficult to motivate people unless they... Well, I mean, some people motivate people with fear, but trust works better.
We'll touch on trust building in a moment, but yeah. What part of company building do you find entrepreneurs or business owners and leaders deceiving themselves with the most?
I don't know what percentage of businesses don't work out. Do you?
Very high.
Very, very high. Well, on the whole, the single biggest explanation for that is a lack of truth. I mean, it's as simple as that. In other words, the person starting the business wasn't prepared to engage in the reality of their service or their product or whatever it was. They were just living in cuckoo land. You do need to live up to a point in cuckoo land because you have to believe in something. You have to believe in your vision for something. So that's brave and unusual. But then you also have to apply common sense and reality to that.
So the balance is being obsessed or living in cuckoo land when it comes to your vision and what you believe the world could look like, and then being very realistic about what it is today.
It's not that complicated. If you apply it to, let's say, I watched a TV program the other day about Dyson and his Hoover. And what you know, I don't know how many thousands of failed attempts he had at making that thing, but he believed that if he could only conquer that technology and he could suck up the dust more effectively and not put it in a bag, he would one day sell a product which is more effective at picking up dust. Then he realized, I imagine, he realized it had to look, it was going to be more expensive, so it had to look fantastic, feel fantastic. The marketing had to be fantastic. The product had to work over and over again. So there's it calls for a level of vision and commitment and honesty. In other words, when his early prototypes didn't work, he had to fight on until they did work. So in a big scheme of things, he is a good example of someone who, not everyone builds a company like his, but in its own little tiny way, if you apply that to a brownie or a cookie or a coffee shop, it's the same. There's no difference.
And you've applied it with Itsu with...
I haven't applied it. I've tried. It's a journey. And it's a journey which I take seriously. It's a journey which we all take seriously here at Itsu. And we are learning. I've always said, I think it's going to take 100 Itsus before it's making sense. And we're at about 83 now. So we've got 17 left to get it right. And then we can quickly go back and put all the others right. Not that they're wrong. They're not wrong, but they're not Dyson number 50, you know.
100 is quite, and it's a...
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
But most people also think they got it right when they got 2.
It's also an arbitrary number. And yes. So the quality is how do you actually measure when it's right?
It's a good point. Everything is arbitrary, you know. Complexity is horrible. 100 may not be right, but that's not the point. It could be 80. I know it's not 80 because we have 80. It could be 120. I don't know. I hope it's at 100.
But how will you know when it's right?
Oh, God, that's a hell of a good question. It'll never be 100% right. You know when it's right when you can delegate it to other people, when you don't have to be all over them. You can watch it work. In other words, you can watch the consumers and customers embrace it and you can see it, that it doesn't break. There are lots of ways you can gauge the effectiveness and success of what you do. In our case, you know, food business is particularly difficult, but that's not that difficult to engage, to work out if it's working.
Can you give an example of either a part of Itsu that you think has worked and how you could?
Like anyone who knows anything about the food business, it's a very, very complex arena, food, because your customers are all professionals. In other words, we eat 3 times a day on the whole, so we know when food's good or bad. It's not like buying a handbag or a pair of shoes. You don't know how to make a handbag. I mean, you really honestly have no idea how to make a pair of shoes either, most people. So if we're told we believe these shoes are beautifully made, we've paid a premium price for them, they come from a beautiful retailer, which is aspirational and all the rest, we'll be happy with the shoes. And they're comfortable and they look nice. The thing about food is so many of us cook and we know when food's good or bad. So we can afford to be extremely judgmental, and we are as customers. So you can't cheat people with food. It's either right or it's kind of wrong. It's either, you know, cheap or expensive or whatever, organic or not organic. I mean, you can go on forever. So it's a very difficult arena because you can't fool anyone. Do you see what I mean?
Of course.
It's not like there's no trickery in it.
So this is a precursor to the larger subject, which is innovation. Yes. The number of experiments, the number of repetitions you're willing to do. How do you incentivize that in your team in a very practical way?
That's a good question. You have to. It comes deep within the organization, doesn't it? In other words, what is the purpose of this organization? We have a company called Itsu Grocery, which designs and creates food in East Asia, and brings it here and and we sell it all over the country. The main purpose of that company is innovation. So the entire team embraces their role as innovators. They have no interest in producing an identical spring roll to that sold in Tesco. If they're going to do a spring roll, it's got to be the best, the most beautiful, the most delicious, the most affordable spring roll ever. We are innovators here. We understand our purpose. So when you ask how do you motivate your teams to embrace innovation, it's pretty fundamental. We take it for granted in this company, and I'm sure a great many of your viewers understand their role in being innovative is fundamental.
So then how do you hire for that?
It's a difficult thing to hire for, but what you can, on the whole, accept is that a great many people love embracing the opportunity to create new. They really do. I have unbelievable faith in humanity, that people crave beauty and newness and something beautiful. They do. They do. They just need the handcuffs taken off them. And they need to be set free to think and to dream and to help create the process of something really beautiful.
What are the handcuffs in this method?
The handcuffs are... commerce is riddled with handcuffs. Commerce is difficult because profit is elusive unless you're in, betting or something. Not that I know anything about betting, but on the whole, profit is elusive. It's quite elusive in the food business. Margins are small. So people are they play safe. Leaders play safe. Companies play safe. Teams play safe. The whole thing comes about playing safe. So if a packet of biscuits got to cost £2, you take a brave person to launch a packet of biscuits at £4. God, they've got to be damn good biscuits.
So the handcuffs in the food industry is the fact that there are
terribly
thin
difficult.
Margins.
Very thin margins. Huge habits, long-standing, decades of habits. So you've got to break the whole cycle.
We zoom out and look at commerce on the whole. What are the handcuffs that stop people from innovating?
That's a very good question. Why are there such handcuffs in commerce? And why do people behave so often in such negative ways? And that's all driven by fear, I think. In other words, if you work very, very hard and you reach a certain status in the commercial enterprise in which you work, the company in which you work, let's say, you're going to be driven quite a lot by fear, by screwing up, by making terrible decisions on your product, your marketing, your pricing, your this, your that. So on the whole, you'll play safe. And that basically, playing safe equals, to me, handcuffs. Because how can you progress if you're just playing safe? How are you going to get excitement and progression if you're always doing every decision you make is from fear?
So how do you create a safe environment such that your team here...
it's fundamental. I think it comes down to the organization. I've been lucky enough to work with people and build an industry, a business where trust is high and you try and eradicate fear. Make a decision. If it's wrong, fine. It doesn't matter. Then undo it. But be brave. Knock the walls down. We'll never build anything great by just doing the same as we did yesterday. You've got to be brave. Do you see? I mean, how do you think that man built SpaceX? It was extraordinary. Those rockets landing vertically. Absolutely mind-blowing.
Interesting about Elon, though, is that he is very ruthless and has extremely high expectations of all of his employees and pushes them very hard. So how do you balance?
I don't know anything about him. I've never met him. But on the whole, anyone who's setting out, one of your viewers, just to build a product and sell it, you've got to have pretty high expectations. Otherwise, your product won't work. So how you motivate people, that's everyone has their different style. I don't know him.
You've said before that you're quite demanding as a boss.
I'm demanding of the product. Yeah, I don't kid myself. I don't believe in bullshitting myself. If a product needs to be outstanding, then it needs to be outstanding. And just because it reaches a certain level doesn't mean 2 years later you look at it and think, crikey, this could be much better. And how exciting, what an amazing opportunity, and let's rise to it. Yeah, I love the pursuit of excellence. It's wonderful.
Does that pursuit of excellence in the product trickle down to being demanding of your team?
Yes.
What does that look like?
What does it look like? I don't know. I should think it varies from day to day.
Can you give me an example?
That's a really difficult one. It's a combination of things. It's a combination of time, education, explanation of vision, coaching, mentoring. It's time. You know, you can't expect people to grasp your vision overnight. Because a vision for something is, if it was that simple, we'd all have one. We'd all be, you know what I mean? It's, in other words, it takes time. It takes a little bit of time to understand a true vision. So, you know, we were in a food meeting yesterday where the team had spent a lot of time and trouble, and they'd done a lot of research to ascertain that every bite of a particular prawn gyoza needed to be identically perfect. That meant that the contents of this prawn gyoza was, in my opinion, way too mashed up. So in order to get the exact same amount of prawn in every single bite, obviously you had to start off by mashing the prawn up. Also, if you ask 100 people to design a food product with regard to seasoning, you'll probably end up getting more and more bland, okay? And so they tried their absolute hardest, but in my opinion, it ended up with a mush which was bland, which in theory 100 people liked. But as someone who's passionate about real food and food tasting like you made it at home and food which was confident, I didn't like it. And my job was to explain why natural-looking, imperfect food with the right amount of seasoning is fundamentally important. How I deliver that message sometimes is better than other, you know.
You come across as visibly very passionate in all of your interviews, in every conversation I've researched you on. How important is this passion when building businesses?
I think passion is quite important because you need a lot of energy, sustainable energy, to get through this. And passion can't be faked, I don't think. I mean, I really, really deeply love what I do. I really care about it. I really love that pursuit of excellence. And when you get it, I find it totally captivating and enthralling because I know it's there. It's always there, you know, just over the horizon. It's there. And it gives other people a great deal of joy. So why not search for it? So I suppose I'm afraid that's just part of the process for me, that joy and the love of it, the pursuit of real beauty, beauty of a product, beauty of a design, and the beauty of the success when people realize they've created something truly wonderful.
Passion, courage to search for truth.
Yes.
These are some core tenets of people who great business leaders. Yeah. What are some other traits?
Don't know. Oh God, you can read them all. But I have about 500 books on the subject, and I read them a lot. Actually, there are hundreds of books on that subject of leadership, subject of management. My advice to everyone is read them all. Read them all. Make notes. Read them all. You'll learn.
Starting where?
Start at the beginning. Just go and buy some.
As in, what's your
Google favorite? The 10 best books ever written on the subject of management.
What's your favourite?
No, it varies. I really can't tell you. No, I think there was book. There's I bought 60 of this paperback book the other day. I think it's called
No Bullshit Leadership.
Yes. It's a really good, simple, easy book to read. If you only ever read one book on leadership, it's a pretty good one. Because it was about the truth, searching for the truth.
Which of your traits do you think has contributed to your success alongside
tenacity?
Courage? What does that mean?
I'm very tenacious. I'll never give up. I love it. I love the process. You can't give up. Do you understand? It's like anyone who's viewing you who wants to do something, run their own company, they've got to passionately believe in the product. And they've really got to ask themselves a lot of searching questions. You know, you can't expect everyone else to feel as excited as you about the product. Not until it's great. And otherwise, and the other thing is often you make 5 or 6 terrible failures in shitty products and it'll be the 7th which works. So never, you can't give up. We've had terrible failures, but you've got to plow on. You've got to understand why you made the failures, what happened, and try not to make them again.
So what's your attitude towards failure?
I think it's good. You have to embrace it. You've got to go for it. Accept that 20% of everything you do will be a failure. It's fine. Half, 50% starts getting a bit exhausting, but 20% is fine.
Going back to this search for excellence and passion for the product, you have one of Steve Jobs' own original MacBooks in your lobby.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What does that represent for
you? No, I saw it in auction in California. Steve Jobs' own computer, which was on his desk for 5 years. And I bought it to put in our reception because I thought it was just good. And the message on it is good. You know, that it's just an endless pursuit of excellence. And it's one of the early computers, so it's a nasty little thing. Long before he created that phone, that product we all have now in our pocket. You know, just remind you how you start in life.
Apple products are renowned for being deeply emotional and connecting with people on an emotional level, which I've heard you speak about before, in terms of how you're able to trigger emotions through your product or experiences.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
Okay, I think it's much, there's no secret to this. It's really basic. It's human beings respond to beautiful things, buildings, movies, music, products, books, stories, you know. And there's a lot about the way that product interacts with you, which is really emotionally engaging. And that's just hard work. It's just effort. It's hard work. Anything, you know, it's like a food product. You know, if you just, it's all in the last 5%, the beauty. So you can emotionally engage. A room can emotionally engage with people. When you do your house and you decorate your room, it's up to you. How far do you want to go? Do you want to astound or do you just want a boring room? Philip Stark made all kinds of household products emotionally engage. You know, do you see what I mean? Beautiful things engage people. Why do you think millions of people go to Florence every year or go and look at the Taj Mahal? These things are remarkable. They're the vision of people. They're beautiful. They're engaging.
How do you balance practicality with beauty?
It's a good question. They have to work in harmony. They can work in harmony. And the best things and experienced products life do work in harmony. In other words, they're really useful and they work really well and they're really beautiful. And hopefully not just the same or worse than what went before. You see what I mean? Or just cheaper. There's always space for cheaper, but it's not that enthralling, just cheaper.
So if we're thinking about now Itsu and the gap that you speak about there being between where it's now and when it really hums or clicks into place, what's missing?
A great, great many people in the developed world across the entire globe, they wish they could buy affordable, nutritious food. But it's extremely difficult to make affordable, nutritious food fresh for, you know, under £8 or £7. On the whole, you have to pay a lot of money for nutritious food because it's very unstable. Fast food, generally speaking, is very, very highly processed, frozen. It behaves very well. It's very stable and it's in harmony with its production system. So the big hamburger places or the fried chicken places are able to keep their prices down because their food is extremely well behaved. They have a lot of process and usually, not always, a lot of fat, salt and chemicals, which keep the food stable. I don't know how many chemicals there are, but sometimes I've heard 27 different chemicals in a single French fry. I mean, you know, it's a lot. The point of Itsu is to sell nutritious, good food without any UPFs at all. So it's extremely unstable, very naughty, very badly behaved. Fresh vegetables, fresh, you know, whole grain brown rice, really very fragile food. So in other words, your process to handle that has to be unbelievable. And it's taken us 20 years and 100 kitchens and 100 Itsus to get it so it works.
So what's there left to do?
Because the job's not finished yet. You know, yesterday we were tasting the prawn dumpling version 7, I think. 5 years work to get to this. So in other words, if you have a vision for something completely new, the point, it's used East Asian food. It's very difficult to do fast food with many of the cuisines of the world. But actually, East Asian food, it does work. Because you have broth, you have noodles, you have brown rice, you have dumplings, you have bao, there are various things which really help you. We have robots which make sushi maki rolls and sushi rice. In other words, they do the work of 3 or 4 people, those robots. And they have been developed by the Japanese brilliantly over the last 50 years. So East Asian food can be, for us, for it's the food of the future, affordable, nutritious food. But we're on a journey. It's not over yet. It's not over yet at all.
What I don't understand is when you know whether it isn't over.
It's never over. Never over. I don't think it's ever over. I mean, you can churn and go around and make the same mistakes, but it won't be over for another 20 years. McDonald's, I think, is 80 years old, I believe, something like that. And they have consistently standards of cleanliness, which is pretty great. I would love to have the standards of cleanliness which surpass them. How will we get there? I don't know, but we're working on it.
McDonald's bought a stake in Pret's.
They did, yeah.
A while back.
We did that because we thought that we'd learn how to build the company internationally from them, but it didn't work out.
And Pret changed quite a lot after it was bought by private equity. How do you feel it's evolved since you've been involved?
Well, it's grown. I read yesterday that it's going to have sales of 1.2 billion. It's quite a lot for a sandwich shop, from one shop. If you think how it's evolved from one single idea to that. And if it continues to evolve, there's no reason why it won't get to 2 or 3 or 4 billion of sales and feed a lot of people. I had a very good experience today in a Pret-a-Manger. Amazing. Really astounding, actually. So there's always hope.
Can you tell us about your experience today?
No, my experience today was, there's so many Pret-a-Mangers, but this particular one I hadn't been to before. And it was a work of art because it was run by somebody with an entire team of people who clearly were very, very passionate about their responsibilities. The leader was obviously extremely engaged because this place was a complete work of art. It was beautiful to see it. It was immaculate. The service was extraordinary. There wasn't a single thing out of place. It was a business run with great pride and joy by that whole team. So it was lovely to see it.
This seems to be a common thread throughout both Itsu and Pret's, is the team members which have a lot of pride and joy in the work. But I'd love to get very practical. How do you find that?
Well, you have to start off by accepting the fact that if you want to enthrall your customers, how on earth are you going to do that unless you have a team of people who are, proud of what they do and trust each other and take care and want to grow as people? You can't. That's everything. If you don't believe that, don't believe anything. I mean, it's fundamental. We've always put it first. We haven't always achieved it, and very often we don't. But my goodness gracious, it's first, number one.
So how do you find it?
How? You don't. You build it. You build it. There's 1,000 Lego pieces. I remember years ago when we had leftovers in Pret-a-Manger number 1 or 2. We were traumatized by what you do with 50 sandwiches left over, which people have spent hours making with care and love. What you do, they didn't want to take them home. So that's when we realized we couldn't throw them away. You couldn't throw them away. It was just evil. So that's when we started taking them to this little homeless shelter under the bridge. And that grew into something, like all these things, it grew into something huge until every Pret in the world was delivering its sandwiches and its salads to the homeless shelters, because it was fundamentally wrong to throw them away. It was just evil. So that's one tiny example of pride. If you take pride in your products, treat the people with a huge amount of respect and the products. In Itsy, we have a half price sale. So everything is half price. So we don't waste the love and energy and the food you're better to give it away than, and we don't make any money on that. But it's surely just common sense, isn't it? Pride, you know, pride's very elusive, I can assure you. But it's fundamental.
There are quite a few examples of you making decisions based on common sense or your intuition or your gut feel.
Yes. Yeah.
Things like the joy of Pret's button, giving things away, doing things that feel right.
Yes.
Our intuition is often built off of life experiences.
Yeah.
Sometimes those are beneficial, sometimes they're actually detrimental.
Yeah.
And so where can you trust your intuition and where are the limits of
it? Well, it's down to your employer. It comes back to that handcuff thing. A great many employees all over the world are not trusted because of the fear of their bosses and who they report to. So you build a culture where there's no trust at all. So they're not able to make common sense, emotionally engaging decisions. They're just not. They're forbidden. So it's not worth making them because they'll get into trouble or someone will get into trouble. Or you build an entire culture where the organization just doesn't accept emotional. Emotions are quite inconvenient in commerce. So that's something you need to combat all the time. Yeah, it's very interesting, the concept of a loyalty scheme. Itsu actually has a loyalty scheme, which we do give away butterflies to, and it's structured because nowadays you can have an app and and a great many people value it. But in the old days when there was no app and there was no means of doing that, Pret used to give away. Yeah, and it was wonderful. We left it up to every single individual, what they gave to whom and what and whenever they wanted. That was a wonderful, uplifting loyalty scheme.
So it sounds like this trust you have in your teams allow people to bring their more emotional, intuitive selves to work.
I'm afraid you have to. Most people are good, you know. I believe, my heart, 99% of people are good. I left my phone in a London taxi two nights ago, and the taxi driver went to unbelievable lengths to try and find me and get my phone back to me. Really kind, noble man. And I hope I treated him with beautifully. But most people are good. You just got to... Bad people are very disruptive. So you need to put your arms around those who are wounded. But especially in retailing, you know, theft is more common now. People are more rude than ever before. It's difficult being a retailer. People I work with get abused all the time. It's horrible.
Can you give a practical example of somewhere where you trust your team where potentially other businesses don't?
I can't really. I wouldn't know because I don't work for other businesses, so I don't really know. But I trust my team and all the people I work with enormously. You have to, otherwise you can't build a business, you see. I mean, we have 2,000 members, 2,000 people I work with. At any one point, you know, I'm only near one or two of them, or if that. So, of course, you've got to trust them. I trust them completely.
But I'd love to know, what does this look like in practice?
It's too complex. I can't paint a picture of trust. It's too big. It's too fundamental. I don't know where to begin. It's everything. It's earned, isn't it?
How do you earn trust?
Trust is earned by your behaviours, I guess. I mean, you have to take a risk because if there's no time, when you employ someone, you bring someone to your team, it's best just, you have to throw caution to the wind. You have to trust them and you just have to hope it works out. And when it does, when you see the glimmer of hope, you've got to pile on the rewards and the motivation because then there'll be more. You know what I mean? You've got to build trust. It's one of our four, it's been built completely on four, what we call its qualities. I build trust is one of them.
I care, I want to grow, I take pride.
Yeah.
And I
those
trust.
Four.
How did you come to those four?
To me, they were obvious. I mean, they're not right or wrong. You could have had eight, you could have had 10, you could have 20, you could have one, I don't know. We just landed on four. Years ago, some brilliant young person I worked with wrote out the three and they seemed wonderful to me. And actually the fourth, I build trust, came later. funnily enough.
Why is that?
Then it just did. I think because when you're a small company, I care and I take pride and I want to grow were more important than suddenly when you find you have 100 people, 200 people, suddenly trust becomes really, really important. But it wasn't in, it was less important in the very early days. We were real pioneers, you know. We were on this crusade. We're a tiny group of people.
Speaking of the different stages.
Yes.
How have you had to evolve as a leader throughout the different stages of the business?
I think you have to rely, you have to force yourself and teach yourself and believe more and more and more in that, those that I build trust. As the business gets bigger, you have to just trust. It's tricky.
What else have you had to lean more into?
Well, I think the bigger you get, you have to be calmer. Be calm. You can't let your emotions run away with you.
More so at the beginning.
But you've got to set a high standard. You've got to communicate. You've got to be accountable to be there. You've got to be, what I mean by being accountable is you've got to support the people you work with, properly support them. You've got to stick with, be there for the truth as well.
What does that mean?
Someone's got to stand up for the customer and the product, the reality of what it's really like. Someone's got to keep pushing that. Is the product as good as it could be, and why? When it's not, how do you do that? Don't know. I mean, most of these, in other words, if you were to ask me what is the role of a founder, if the founder's still in their organization, I'd say that's probably it. To keep the vision going and to remain in love with the product, whatever the product is. Don't you think? What else?
And to keep pushing for the truth.
Yeah, to keep pushing for the truth. Is the product wonderful? And if not, what are we going to do about it?
But I'd love to know what's different from when it's first 10 people to now it's...
It's very, very easy to answer that. When it's at the beginning, it's up to you to make the product wonderful. As you get bigger, you can't. It's up to someone else. So your job is to enthrall them, motivate them, guide them, because you can't make the product wonderful. You know, you've got to teach others and they'll do it. But they've got to believe in the vision.
When you think about the product, you have the end product that the users or the customers experience.
Yes.
But if you zoom out a little bit, the business itself is a product. And so do you think about excellence and beauty in the same way when it comes to business?
Well, you have
or more
to do
so
both, you see. That's one of the problems of your viewers is if you really want to start a business, you're going to have to not only handle the product, you've also got to handle the structure and strategy of your business. So it's quite demanding. But if you're really smart, you try and get someone else who's much better than you at one or other. That's a good bit of advice. Very few people can do it all.
Which bit can you do?
I'm more of a creative person. I'm in love with the product. I'm not that good at managing people. It's not my skill, really. Some people are hopeless at it, but I'm very in love with the product.
Who in the team complements that side of
you? Well, I'm lucky. In my case, the co-founder of Pret was much better than me at dealing with all the business strategy and the money, the banks, the lawyers. He was great. He did all the things I couldn't do. And Clive went on to be the CEO of Pret and did a great job. And has, joined me at Itsu. He's been with Itsu for years. He's got all the qualities I don't have. So you have to be aware. You need to be aware of your own qualities, what you're good at and what you're bad at. That's a given, isn't it?
Which part of yourself would you like to build more awareness in?
I'm fine. You can't. There's no point worrying about that. You are who you are. You can just be the best you can be. There's no point grumbling about, I wish I could be an accountant. I'm not an accountant.
But that's different. There's leaning into our strengths, but also being aware of our strengths and weaknesses. And so which
Well, areas? Most people aren't aware of their weaknesses. They don't embrace them. A lot of entrepreneurs, your viewers, how many of them are really prepared to embrace what they're completely useless at? I don't know. We'll see. But my advice to them is, embrace what you're useless at. Be honest about it and go and find someone who's good at it.
So what are you useless at?
What am I useless at? Oh, I'm useless at many things. I'm not a good manager. I'm not particularly good with figures, money. I'm not good with discipline. I'm follow up on many things I'm not very good at.
You're not good with discipline?
No, I'm not very good with the discipline of management. I'm not a good manager. I don't focus enough. I don't concentrate enough. I'm more in love with what could be rather what is. I'm not particularly interested in what happened last month or last year. I'm always about the future. And in fact, that's a bit weak because companies move much slower than people like I would like. That's things move. They don't move at a pace which someone like me likes.
So how do you get them to move faster?
Well, maybe you shouldn't. You know, a great many brands have existed over 100 years and they plod on. They have their place. They do what they do really well. And other, there's a great many examples, I'm sure, of companies which dropped the ball, and had they just stuck with their knitting better, they would have built something wonderful. But I don't know. But I'm quite impatient.
You're impatient, but you also take a 30-year view.
I take a 30-year view, yeah. I take a 30-year view, I do. I've said that many times, I really do. I think things don't happen overnight. You can't expect customers. Many are issues, you know, take 3 years to really become very successful. And, you know, you've got to be patient.
Jeff Bezos likes to talk not about what the future could look like in terms of what could be, but also instead what's not going to change.
Really?
And so then what do you think is not going to change in the next 30 years?
Well, I'm not sure if all that line of thought is particularly positive, in the sense that in the food business, I don't think people are going to start peeling potatoes and cooking more. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the pattern. People are becoming more and more impatient. They're relying more and more on instant satisfaction. Is that good or bad? Obesity is really, really on the up. Terrible. So our role, in many ways, its role in its grocery business and its restaurants is suddenly really finding its feet, because at last you can get nutritious, affordable food. But I don't rejoice in the fact that people are 60% of our youth are obese. I think it's tragic. It's awful.
What about in the workplace? What's not going to change?
I'm not sure. I mean, what matters is your viewers, and what are they going to change in their workplaces? I mean, in the workplace generally, why should things change much? Humans have evolved over millions of years. Nothing's going to change particularly quickly. I mean, oh yeah, you can have a fallout from COVID and work from home, and we'll see. But I don't think it's arrogant to think that human beings are suddenly going to change just because we hit 2030. Of course they're not. We're millions of years old.
If you could snap your fingers and change a part of human nature, what would you
do? I can't. I couldn't. I've never given that any thought, because it's not going to happen.
What about you're very intuitive?
No, I couldn't answer that without sounding like a fool, because it's not going to happen. No, we need to focus on what we can do, not the impossible, I think. There's enough difficulty in changing what we really can change, without going into the ether and saying, well, wouldn't it be nice if? Our job as entrepreneurs, your viewers, is let's do what we really can do and get on with it. Live in the real world. Stop fantasizing. Get on with it. If you have a product up your sleeve, get on with it. Live in the real world. That's you mentioned Jeff Bezos the other day. He says every day he goes to work and he thinks of Amazon as a startup. There's a good little bit of advice. That's exhausting, but he's right. He's right. Be accountable. Be real. He's right. No wonder he's so damn built such a big business. I'm not sure if it's good or bad. I think it's nothing to do with me, but he's right about that.
If you viewed Itsu more as a startup?
We do. We try to. I swear, we try to.
You be better?
If we could all view it as a startup, it would be a lot better than it is. Yeah, of course.
In what way?
Well, it would be more dynamic, more immediate. There'd be less fear. As soon as a company becomes really successful and big, people are scared of putting one foot in front of the other in case they do damage. You've got to innovate. You've got to be brave. You've got to make mistakes. But then you've got to put them right. I see many, many mistakes in ITSU which are allowed to thrive like a virus for months and months and months and months. These are mistakes which should have been put right the following day. But there's all reasons why.
How do you discover?
Well, you bump into them. You bump into them. And if you're not lethargic and lazy about it, they will offend you and they'll upset you. In other words, the person who's responsible for cleaning Victoria Station, which is, a quarter of a mile from here, I don't think they wander around and go up the escalators and look around Victoria Station with any degree of shame that the place is filthy. The escalators are thick with filth and because for some reason, the state of the place is probably within the boundaries of acceptable to them. But a company like ITSU, we're craving always to do things beautifully, to do it as beautifully as we can. And when it's not, we failed. The question is, do we embrace that failure fast and act and get on with it? Or do we not embrace that failure? It takes courage to embrace the failure.
When was the last time you saw something embraced that wasn't failure. Right and changed it?
Probably exactly yesterday at 8:30 at night when I was with 26 people who work for ITSU and I was confronted by enormous amount of failure. But we rejoice, we deal with it, and already emails were going out at 5 o'clock this morning dealing with it. It's great.
Like what was the failure?
Oh, well, let's fix this, let's fix this, let's fix that, let's fix it. You know, we were celebrating what a load of stuff we do wrong.
That was at the Butterfly Club.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about that?
The Butterfly Club, there are many, many, many ways we do this in a company like ITSU, but there are about, I think, 26 members of a club where we're really dynamic young people, managers, some people from here, the academy. And they're not the bosses of the company. They're not the directors or heads necessarily, but they are very dynamic and they speak their mind. So we get together in a very structured way. They're in groups, and the finance CFO of the business, the COO of the business, we sit with them and we listen. Tell us what is going wrong today, yesterday. So the technology team will listen, the food team will listen. You know, we'll all listen until it hurts, and then we'll go and fix it for them.
What needs to be true for someone to be in the Butterfly Club?
Oh, no, they're elected in by each other. They have shares in the company. They bring each other in. Like-minded people.
Coming near to the end, I'd love to understand more about you as an individual and your drive. Where do you think this passion comes from?
Well, I don't know. That's a very good question because some people watching will think, I mean, the question is it all good or is it bad? In other words, is the drive of the entrepreneur driven by negative force? Fear or trauma, or is it very often actually coming from a pursuit of excellence? So everyone's different. A great many entrepreneurs who've built wonderful companies, it is from a pursuit of excellence, a love of great teamwork, and a wonderful pursuit of a great opportunity to build something wonderful. In my case, is that the case? I don't see why not. Or is it driven by my... I don't think so. I mean, listen, let's deal with the most people.
I'd rather deal with you.
You'd rather, okay. Well, I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know. I think my dream and vision of making really beautiful food, building a place where you can buy hot, delicious food from people who take real pride in what they do. I think it's a wonderful thing to do. Knows no end, the beauty of it. And the same with the grocery business. It's just no end to the beauty of it. Imagine we spent 4 years, I think, on miso, one single product, getting it right. 4 years. I went to Japan the other day for 2 days just to taste miso broth in this extraordinarily beautiful place in the Nagano Valley with an amazing team of people. It's enthralling. really enthralling. So I feel very privileged.
I find that, as you mentioned, passion and drive can stem from some insecurity or lack.
Yeah.
Or it can stem from an abundance. I often find that it evolves between the two. Yeah. So it can potentially start from a place of scarcity and evolve into recognizing the abundance and things.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
The scarcity in both of our lives is disconnection, loss of parents. I remember you saying when you were living with your father, you were in the kitchen a lot. You were cooking with the chef there when he was entertaining guests.
Yeah.
What was the balance of...
No, I just watched. I became close to watching this person work and their passion and the food and understanding the pursuit of excellence from this chef, actually. It was very interesting. Very, very interesting. I realized it was all in the last 5% and the pride and joy. I became rather obsessed by food and cooking during those years, the very formative years. But I honestly don't think you need to try and dig down into what drives people to build successful companies and successful products. It doesn't have to come from a negative place at all, a loss of a parent or any of those things. It really honestly doesn't. I know many people who've had fabulously wonderful childhoods and fabulously loving relationships who've built successful companies.
One thing I heard you say in another interview is that you wanted to make a difference, to be admired, be successful and do something interesting, great. I wanted people to look at me and say, wow, this guy is so serious and onto something. He matters.
Okay, so that's it. That's deeply personal. That in my case, yes, probably, I lost my mother very young when I was 7. I had a very difficult, sad, at times, childhood. So maybe I must have said that at a moment of reflection when thinking, in my particular case, perhaps I felt ignored as a child. I don't know.
Probably. I empathize with that and also felt ignored by my father, who is similarly very cold, disciplined.
Sure.
And so I've noticed that something in myself is wanting, striving for that recognition from him. Is that something that you relate to?
I don't know. Listen, for years now, the joy I've got from watching the people I work with rise up has given me untold joy and does today, I can assure you. I sit in meetings with a great many young, extraordinary people. But if years and years ago I was traumatized by my mother's leaving us at a very young age, I'm sure it had something to do with the fact I felt insignificant and wanted to do something with my life. I don't know, but it's not something I ponder on now at all. What now enthralls me is working with people and watching them rise up and grasping onto an amazing vision of their own abilities, their own dedication, their own commitment, and what they can do with their careers and their products. That's what's totally enthralling, I promise you.
Well, you're a brilliant testament to focusing on the abundance, and I can feel and see the passion.
Yeah, I know, it's very true. It's all down to them.
Closing tradition on the show is, assuming this is watched by a number of entrepreneurs, is that anything, given that you've been generous enough to give us your time, is there anything that we can support you on as a community?
No, I get many, many, many emails each week because we make it very, very public on our bags. I ask people to write to me exactly about their experience in it. So I get a lot. I don't need any more. But I write back to them, everybody. So in other words, I already get a lot of feedback, more feedback than most business product bosses. I just want them to believe in that thing, in the trust. Build trust, stick to your vision, and damn well stick to the truth. Love the truth. Don't waver from it.
What a beautiful way to end. Thank you so much.
Thank you.